Hey, this is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week's guest is professional bodybuilder Emily Duncan. Emily is an IFBB certified professional bodybuilder. She's a certified sports nutritionist, a kinesiology student, a bodybuilding.com athlete, and a self-proclaimed quote-unquote normal human being. We go into depth talking about body image issues since she's in a sport that is judged solely on subjective measures. We talk about the balance of living a happy and fulfilled life while striving to achieve great things. Emily is one of the most insightful people that I've ever had on the show. Enjoy the show. Hey, this is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. I'm here with Emily Duncan. Emily, it's so great to connect with you after so long. Thanks for making some time for this.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Mike. I remember you texting me about a week ago asking if I would be on the podcast, and I about pissed my pants because this has been one of my favorite podcasts for a couple of years now. So it's a really huge honor to be on the show.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. So when I met you, you had just become one of the very first donuts and deadlifts athletes way back then. And maybe even put yourself even a little bit before that. Did you ever dream of being where you are today as such a well-recognized fitness athlete? Where did you hope to go when you were first starting out? What were your dreams?
You know, I absolutely had no idea that this is where I would end up, but that it's happened in the best way possible. I guess when I first started out, my goals weren't set on any type of sponsorship whatsoever, any sort of recognition. I just wanted to compete. My primary goal was to earn a pro card at some point in the sport, which I'm still working on. But yeah, my primary goal starting out was just to do well. You know, I grew up a dancer and I grew up dancing competitively. So when I had to stop dancing due to injury, I needed some kind of competitive outlet, and I just wanted so badly to be back on stage in some way, shape, or form. So kind of getting into bodybuilding and competing, that's what that was for me. And so it was just kind of filling that need to be up on a stage. But yeah, my primary goal was just to do well, place a national, get a pro card, and then just this whole world of fitness, and even more so like fitness, social media and sponsorships and all of that. It just kind of opened up. And happened really, really fast, to be quite honest. Like when you think in retrospect, you know, I would say things really took off in about a year. And when you're super young too, I was a teenager at the time, when you're super young and all that starts happening, you don't really know what to do with yourself, but definitely didn't expect it. But I'm definitely extremely grateful for it.
So let's back up even further. So you said your sport. Can you tell the listeners what your sport is and how it's differentiated between the other ones?
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. You know, so I compete in bodybuilding. I compete in the NPC, which is the amateur level of the IFBB, which are the two largest bodybuilding federations, I believe, in the world. I compete in the bikini division. And what differentiates bodybuilding from other sports is it's not a performance-based sport. You know, I think people forget this a lot. Especially people that are in bodybuilding. Other sports are judged based on a performance or, you know, a lift or something that you do on competition day. Bodybuilding, it's not that way. You're just judged on the physique that you bring to competition day. So my sport isn't based on, you know, three attempts at two lifts or three lifts or whatever it is, or, you know, performing a series of events. It's judged based on how you show up that day and how you look, essentially, in balance of muscularity and conditioning and all that good stuff. So it's definitely kind of a wild card sport, because I really don't think there's any other sport out there that is that way.
Right. Not so much subjectivity. I think it has some similarities to like artistic gymnastics.
Right.
Right. Because that is up to the judge's eye, if you will, not like pounds on a bar or crossing a certain line or making something in a hoop. But it definitely has the highest level of subjectivity, which I definitely want to get more into in a little bit. So how does the bikini division differentiate from the other divisions?
It's most commonly differentiated as it's the lowest level of muscularity. So you have bikini division, which generally they based the look on, and also a big thing with it, it's the lowest level of muscularity, but it's also about the entire package that you bring to the stage, not just the physique you bring, but, you know, even down to your hair, your nails, your makeup, your shoes, your suit, the color of your suit, how it complements your skin tone and your eyes and all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. Very girly. Mm-hmm. Not to say that those things don't matter in the other divisions, but yes, it is the lowest degree of muscularity. It typically also requires less leanness than other divisions. That's definitely changing. When I competed about a year ago, I was sub 10% as a female. So it's definitely still extremely lean. Like, it's pretty much just essential body fat at that point, and it's only getting leaner. But they're looking primarily in terms of judging criteria, they're looking at your posing, all the other things I mentioned before, you know, your entire package that you bring. But then when it comes down to muscle, they're looking for balance. They're looking for what's called an X frame. So with figure, you have more of what's called a Y frame, but bikini is the X frame. So you have wider collarbones that come into a narrow waist and then fuller glutes. And then you have the divisions above it would be figure, where they are a bit more muscular, a bit more conditioned. And then physique, which they're even more muscular and even more conditioned. And with women's physique, they also have a full choreographed routine, whereas with figure and bikini, they only have, you know, your mandatory poses that you mesh together into your routine. So yeah, bikini in a nutshell, lowest degree of muscularity, but largely focused on delts and glutes, and then overall presentation and stage presence, which for somebody that grew up on stage and in performance, that definitely played to my advantage a lot.
Right. So it's really interesting. So you use the word girly, but to get to achieve the type of physique that you're going after, that is, you know, what everyone's going after, it takes what is usually considered a very masculine approach, which is lifting heavy ass weights. When you were growing up, how would you characterize yourself? Were you more of a girly girl, a tomboy, somewhere in between?
I would definitely say I was somewhere in between. It's actually really funny that you ask that, because when I was in like fourth to fifth grade, I went through a hardcore tomboy phase. Literally was wearing like double XL t-shirts. I wore a wristband that's made out of like the terry cloth material. I had this headband that I literally wore every single day to keep my hair out of my eyes. I would play basketball with the boys. I would play soccer with the boys. And so, yeah, I definitely had my tomboy phase. But then also growing up in dance, I grew up with the very what is seen as feminine qualities of grace and poise and all of that. So I'd say I was definitely a mixture. You know, I've always been into being active and, you know, using my body, but I've also always been into, you know, the quote unquote girly things like hair and makeup and stuff like that. So I'd say I was a mix.
Awesome. So you've always been into powerlifting and Olympic lifting as part of your training program, and which is definitely not the norm in your sport. I think the norm is more dumbbells and machine regimen. Mm-hmm. So why do you incorporate so many of those lifts in your routine?
It's funny how it started out. So back in June of 2014, that was right after my first competition season ended, which for that prep, I definitely did more of the stereotypical bodybuilding style prep. But also at the same time, I was offered a job as an assistant coach at a sport performance facility where I grew up in Dayton called the Next Level Speed and Strength. And I vividly remember walking into my first day of work, and the strength coaches were having the guys do a mock weightlifting meet for their workout for the day. I was enthralled. I had never seen Olympic lifting before in my life. And after that, I was like, can you teach me how to do this? Mm-hmm. Like little old me just walking in first day, like, hey, can you teach me how to do this? I've never done this. This looks really cool. And like, I just like things that look like they're kind of badass, and this looked kind of badass. So I was like, yeah, let's do this. But then also it was kind of like, I was the only female at the time, the only female in a large male facility. You know, all of our athletes at the time were male, all of our coaches at the time were male, and you know, our owner was male. So I was the only female there, and especially from the athlete perspective, from the other athletes, not me as the athlete, but being an assistant coach, I wanted to be able to show them, it almost like earn their respect in a way, because you know, females in the strength conditioning environment are definitely not as prevalent as males. So I felt like I almost kind of had to earn my place there and be like, hey, I can do exactly what you can do, so you should still listen to me because I'm still your coach, even if I'm a girl. But honestly, it was the best thing that could have happened. Like, it turned into so much more. Like I said, I just started an off season for my first season of bodybuilding, and I feel like we'll probably get into this more later, but people often deal with their most severe body image issues as a result of competing in bodybuilding in their off seasons. Mm-hmm. So starting something, I'm the type of person I really like having and almost need, definitely need, not almost need. I need tangible, measurable, quantifiable goals. That's why prepping for a contest works so well for me. So going into an off season, I needed something measurable and quantifiable, and strength training is very measurable and quantifiable. You know, are you getting better? Are you lifting better? Are your numbers going up or are they not? You know, it's really easy to measure. And just truly being able to experience what my body was capable of learning and doing instead of just how it looked on stage. That was like a saving grace for my first off season and like successive off seasons, and setting me up for, like, I guess you could say, a mentally peaceful future. And then just also strength movements like squatting, deadlifting, pressing, and especially the Olympic lifts. I feel like more women, especially in bikini, need to be doing Olympic lifts. They're really great for what the bikini division focuses on delts and focuses on your glutes. You know, you look at an Olympic lifter, they've got jack delts and great glutes. I was like, okay, this makes sense. It's fun to train like this. It does what I need it to do. Great. So yeah, trained all the bikini muscles. So it was just like a perfect fit, I guess you could say. And I've just enjoyed it. So I've kept with it.
Yeah. The point that I was going to bring up is that point about it being fun, right? It seems like a much more sustainable way to train. A lot of, like, one of the biggest reasons people fail to stay consistent on any fitness regimen is that it gets stale and they just get tired of doing the same thing. So with Olympic lifting, powerlifting, you're always working on improving the technique, which requires so much precision, and you're focusing on getting stronger. But I love the other point about it giving you a specific goal to work towards in that long off season, where the only goal throughout the year isn't just that one big competition.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It's a lot more entertaining than just, you know, dinking around doing bicep curls. There's a lot more to it than that. And there's a book that I read this past couple of months. I actually had to read it for my strength and conditioning class. It's called The Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. Uh-huh. One of my favorite quotes from that book. And it, you know, pertains to what you're saying about the technique and precision required from Olympic lifts. It talks about, you know, always operating at the edge of your abilities. And that's kind of what Olympic lifting and just strength has been for me. It's always pushing the envelope of your abilities, always operating at that end zone in order to push it to, you know, your next level.
Right. That's like a key ingredient in the recipe for mastery, right? We always have to hone the fundamentals, and we can never neglect the fundamentals, but also we have to be doing things slightly outside of our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How important do you think that the actual program that you follow is compared to your consistency on any program as well as your diet?
So I think there's the whole argument of, oh, it's 90% diet and 10% training. I think that's completely crap. I think it's 100% in each category because, as you know, and it's not just diet training, it's diet training, your sleep, your stress, all of that balled into one, and even more, like your mobility, other mechanisms of recovery, all of that balled into one, and each one of those needs 100%. You know, it's like if you've seen the people that have the spinning plates on the sticks, you know, you're trying to keep all the plates spinning at one time. And if one falls and it's like, oh crap, I got to get this plate spinning again. And so that's like all the systems in your body that as an athlete are so important. So it's definitely not just one or the other. But as far as the actual program itself, I definitely believe that consistency is going to be the main driver, because you could have, this is one of the best lessons that the head coach at Next Level taught me. He was like, you could have the best program in the world. He's like, I could write you the best program in the world, but if you're not going to follow it, it doesn't do anything. And the same thing applies to every athlete in this room. So you could have, you know, a great program, but if somebody isn't able to follow it consistently, whether they don't enjoy it or they're always getting injured or something like that, it's not worth anything. But if you have, you know, a good program that somebody loves doing and they're going to do every single day that they're supposed to be in the gym and they're fired up about it, you're going to get such a better response, and ultimately you're going to be happier, which is the whole, like, overarching point, in my opinion, of why any of us do fitness to begin with. It's to improve our quality of life.
Right.
And so if your program is, like, not enjoyable, you're not going to be consistent with it, and it's not going to do anything. It's a lose, lose, lose all around.
Right. Yeah. And it's we get lost in the mix sometimes. We forget mm-hmm. why we started in the first place. Mm-hmm. I love something that Adi says all the time. She kind of adds to that notion that you just spoke about, that the perfect program is the program that you follow. And she Absolutely. Adds in the harshest of circumstances. So mm-hmm. when you're you just got laid off, when you're on vacation, when it's the holidays, like just when everything is not going your way and you can't stay in your normal routine, you can still stick to this program. I love Absolutely. That. So it's like yeah. it's creating something that fits your lifestyle rather than thinking, oh, I'm going to be the most disciplined person in the world and I'm going to do these 100 things every single day. And then as soon as you stop doing one of them, you just say, fuck it to all of them.
Right. Exactly. One thing I think that bodybuilders do lack in a lot, especially on the, I see this more in the female side, but they don't have enough structure in their programming. So they do a different workout every single time they hit the gym, and there's no way to consistently measure variables or measure progressive overload or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I do think there needs to be some sort of consistency in programming. Right. But yeah, ultimately, at the end of the day, it has to be what you like doing.
I think it's really interesting what you said about the 100% as well. We a friend of ours taught us, ours being Adi and I, taught us like in relationships, rather than thinking about pointing blame as being like divvying up, you know, 50-50 on total blame. Like we each take 100% of we take 100% accountability of our own part. It sounds a lot like what you're talking about. Like you are 100% accountable for every single aspect of your training. And that includes all of those different variables. None of them should be neglected if you want to reach your peak.
Absolutely.
So over the course of your life, especially before getting into the sport, what's been your relationship with your own body image? Were you confident, insecure, a mix? What did that look like in your life?
It's been a ride. So when I grew up, like I mentioned, I grew up dancing. I grew up in a classical ballet studio. I started dancing when I was 1.5, like literally from the point I could walk. I vividly remember, and this is something I try and talk about, you know, whenever I can without being annoying, but because it's so important for young women and their body image and in the messages that we feed them and what we tell them, especially as coaches. But when I was 8, my ballet teacher at the time, so at the end of every year or ballet semester, whatever you want to call it, we would get what were called ballet report cards. And they would have things that were like, you know, technique related. You show up to class on time. Are you nice? Are you good at whatever? Like all that stuff. Are you appropriately dressed? All that. And then at the bottom, they would have, you know, lines for notes. I remember that year was the year where I would be eligible to enter what was called PTD, which was the professional training division of the company. That was kind of like the feeder into the company, as opposed to just being, you know, another kid taking class. And like being admitted to PTD was like my dream as an 8-year-old, mm-hmm. obviously. But I remember on that report card, I had the top marks in everything you could ever imagine. Everything was, you know, 5 out of 5, great, 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 great. But then at the bottom, in giant, it seemed like giant red handwriting, what were the words, Emily will not be admitted to PTD because she does not have a dancer's body type. And so that planted the seed for me at 8 years old that your body is your limiting factor in achieving what you want to achieve with your life. Because, you know, like I said, I was at the time, that was what I wanted to do with my life. And the thing that was holding me back from that was my body. So that was that, like I said, it planted the seed. And then it took about 7 years, 7-8 years for that to like fully come to a head. So I left that dance studio, and over time, I transitioned into a different dance studio that was, you know, more of a contemporary studio, not so much rigid classical ballet. That's where I got into competitive dancing. But I was still dancing. And I remember it was right before my sophomore year of high school is when I developed an eating disorder. And it was primarily related to body image. You know, and there was a lot of pressure on me at the time, too. Like I was on my high school dance team. I was on my studio dance team. I was in clubs and stuff at school. I was trying to make good grades and like go into a new school year, like really, really strong. And just all of this stuff in my life, like came crashing down on me. And like in the back of my head, all those, you know, 8 years leading up was always the constant notion of, Your body is not correct. Your body is wrong. Your body is something that you should be ashamed of, especially as a dancer. You know, I'm built muscularly. I'm not built like the typical waif-like ballerina that's very long and lanky. I'm very tall. I'm 5'9", but I'm not, you know, I'm not thin by any stretch of the imagination. I was always a more muscular dancer, and I always viewed that as wrong. And so that just kind of came to a head at the beginning of that year. And so I developed bulimia and what could be seen as exercise anorexia. So I was dancing over 20 hours a week. And then I would wake up, you know, at 5:30 in the morning before school and run a couple miles before going to class. And I would binge and purge. And then I would dance for hours and hours and hours afterward. And it was just not a good time. And like that whole time, I was never enough for myself. My body was never enough for myself. And by the grace of God, I came out of that on my own. I never had to be like admitted to a therapy center or anything. And in hindsight, it probably would have been good for me to go to some kind of therapy to fully address the issue. But I was able to work myself out of that disorder on my own after about a year. But yeah, that body image growing up was definitely very difficult, especially in the sport that I was in. You know, dancing, you're in tiny little costumes all the time. And when you have somebody tell you at 8, you're too fat to be a dancer, essentially. It's kind of scarring. And so that took a lot of just, and actually I remember I was in a relationship at the time and I was really trying to recover. And we broke up. And one of the last things this guy said to me was like, I can't be with you. You're too screwed up in the head. And I was like, oh, great. That just made the problem that much better. So yeah, growing out of that was in when I was, you know, working my way out of that, I was about 16. I think it was either 15 or 16, however old you are when you're a sophomore. Mm-hmm. Working my way out of that was probably my first like revolution, my first psychological revolution of, you know, becoming a stronger person mentally and learning to not put so much worth in that. And ultimately led to why bodybuilding has been so good for me. We can get into that more, but yeah, long story short, I've had a very tumultuous relationship with body image growing up, for sure.
Yeah, let's go right into that. What were some of the biggest like lessons from that period of your life that have influenced you?
This is hard to put into words. Wow. I've never had to like put that into 100% words. I think the biggest thing was I am so, so grateful for that experience and for dealing with that when I was younger, because it's shown me precisely what I never want to go back to. So when you've struggled with your own issues, like you've struggled with addiction and stuff like that, like, I don't know if this is similar for you, but whenever I think about, you know, the darkest of dark times, I would literally, if we were having like holiday parties at school and I would eat like anything, I would, you know, ask the teacher if I could go to the bathroom. I would take a pencil with me in my pocket and I would go throw up in the most empty bathroom in the school. Like I knew exactly which bathroom would be the least crowded at any given time of day. Like I think of those times, or like hiding trash bags in my room so that I could throw up without my parents noticing and then go take it out to the trash later at night. Like I think about those times whenever I get down on, you know, any situation that I'm in now. And I think, Emily, look at how much you've grown from that. Look at what you never want to go back to. And it's ultimately, we're the strongest in our weaknesses, you know? That's when we're shown, actually, I'm looking at it right now. I have an Epictetus quote in my office. It's difficulties are things that show a person what they are. And so just learning to rise from that pit was probably the biggest lesson. And I remember I'm definitely a very bullheaded person. You know, when I decide I'm going to do something, I'm like, okay, we're doing it. That's the only option. Mm-hmm. But if I don't want to do something, I'm definitely not going to do it. And so I wasn't able to recover until I was mentally okay with doing so. And so then I kind of just told myself, okay, we're going to do this. But that's when I was really introduced to, I guess in hindsight, it would be like positive affirmations. So I had a coach at the time. It was actually my new ballet teacher at the studio that I was at. She had dealt with eating disorders when she was younger and when she was in a ballet company. And so she was a really big guiding light for me. She was like, you need to put, you know, little quotes wherever you need to see them, whether it's by your bed, whether it's in the bathroom, whether it's on your mirror, so that you're reminding yourself of those positive things every single day. And that's what I did. And those little taped pieces of paper with the quotes on them stayed for years and years and years. So, you know, learning the power of positive affirmations and learning the power of thought and the power of what you feed your mind with and the outcome of what you feed your mind with, I guess the metabolization of what you feed your mind with, what does that turn into?
Right.
And then also, I guess another big lesson is I've always been a very self-reliant person, but I would not have gotten through that season of my life without people like my parents or people like my dance coaches. So learning that it's okay and it's necessary to lean on other people when you're struggling, because no man is an island. No matter how much I try to be, I can't get through life completely on my own.
I love it. It's funny. It gives you, going through something like that gives you that perspective that you were talking about, and allows you to do two things. One, in when you go through hard times, you can always go back to, well, at least I'm not there, or look how far I've come. And it also allows you to be grateful for when times are good, because look how far I've come. And then lastly, it's, and I'm sure you can relate, it one of the things that I value so much about myself is my ability to connect with other people that are struggling like that. And I would never be able to connect with them had I not gone through that experience.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I always tell people, you never learn anything from a linear path. Like, if you think of the metaphor of somebody like walking through the woods, if they just have a straightly paved out path for them the entire time to the other side, they're not going to have anything to offer anyone else that's walking through that same path, but may, you know, come across other obstacles. But if you walk into the woods and you, like, there's a fire in the middle of it, or there's like a river that you got to jump over, or there's something else in your way, you learn how to get around that. And that in turn, like you said, it gives you the perspective to help somebody else that's going through, it's a different struggle that they're going through, but it's still a similar experience.
I love that metaphor. So now that you're in
metaphor person, it's
badass. It's a good way to teach. So now that you're in this sport that is judged subjectively on exactly like the way that you look, you know, one of the things that has been one of the biggest challenges in your life, how did it affect you early on joining the sport and getting into it? And how has that changed over time?
So I think at first I was pretty blind to it. I was just like, I was 18 years old. I was dinking around. I was like, oh, this is really, really fun. Like, blah, 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 it's great. But then you start to think about it and you think more about the gravity of it. And I think you've talked about on here the concept of athletic identity. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you're not familiar, anybody listening, with what athletic identity is, it's basically how much you identify with your role as an athlete and how much you want others to acknowledge that role in you. So when you have something like a strength sport or a strength and power sport or a team sport, your athletic identity is grounded in, if you have a strong athletic identity, it's grounded in your performance in the sport or your numbers or, you know, times associated with a given event. But and like when strength and power athletes, they struggle with athletic identity, a lot of times it's when they're injured and thus they can't perform, which is what their identity is grounded in, is their performance. But I've definitely found that the more that, and this is something that I've really done a lot of unpacking of this year, I guess you could say, is with bodybuilding, your sport is judged on your appearance. So if you have an athletic identity within bodybuilding, then your athletic identity lies within what your sport requires, which is the body that you bring to the stage, which is a very, very dangerous and slippery slope for particularly women to go down. So like, if your athletic identity, which is I've been unpacking this, you know, for about the past year, like truly learning like where my athletic identity lies and how to better cope with that. Your athletic identity is grounded in what you look like, which is not safe or healthy for anyone. Mm-hmm. That's not to say you can't compete in bodybuilding and have a healthy outlook on your body, but it's very easy to fall into that trap, especially the more that you do it. And in particular, in my case, the more you succeed. So success is an obstacle in and of itself, because if your athletic identity, it's heightened when you succeed. It's like, oh yes, this is who I am, this is what I do. But then especially with something as transient as your appearance, you know, your looks don't last forever. Mm-hmm. With something as transient as that, if your identity is placed in that, then it's like building a house on sand, or quicksand rather, it's not going to hold up. So you know, and especially when you consider also as a woman, particularly, I know that men have, you know, media messages pumped at them, but it's definitely a largely female issue. You got, you know, this extremely pervasive media narrative of what women are supposed to look like, you know, from women's magazines and the fashion industry and the beauty industry and blah, 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 blah. You have all of these messages being pumped at you as a woman of how you're supposed to be and how who you are. is largely grounded in how you look, and then you couple that with an athletic identity that speaks the same, it presents, it's a breeding ground for a lot of physical insecurity. So just kind of learning to, learning to unpack that this entire year and learn, you know, hey, like just not learn, but come back more in touch with my true values. Mm-hmm. So that I always have that in my arsenal, and so that they're never kind of like we talked about with how everything, you know, with training and nutrition and recovery and all of that is 100%, you know, making sure that all of my values and my athletic identity are working in tandem with each other and not one overshadowing the other or one completely taking over my life. So it's definitely a struggle. As a female, especially as one that has dealt with body image stuff in my past, it's something that I've had to be like very attentive to mentally. And also just like where you place value in yourself is where you ultimately teach others to place value in you. So if you know, your value as an athlete, which, you know, when you're a very serious athlete, your value in yourself as an athlete kind of filters into every other area of your life. That's how you identify yourself. I'm an athlete in such and such sport. But if your primary source of externalized value is in your appearance and your performance in an appearance-based sport, when that inevitably fades, where are you placing your value? And by extension, where are you encouraging others to place value in you? So it's definitely a slippery slope. And that's part of why I'm so huge on not just competing in bodybuilding, but also being educated on the science of strength conditioning, on nutrition and performance, and also using my body kind of like we talked about in strength, you know, via Olympic lifting and powerlifting and things like that. So using my body as, you know, a foundation and a solid component of who I am as a person, as an athlete, and not just as a facility for judgment.
Guys, I hope you're writing this down, putting this on pause and repeating. This is soul food. This is soul food. That's good shit, Emily. I love that. One analogy I really like is we don't want to place our self-worth. We don't want to treat our self-worth like a house on one stilt, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want it to be completely rooted in one area of our life, no matter how great that area is. And athleticism and body image is not, those are just things that are going to go away at some point. And right. So we need other stilts to keep us up. We need family, community. Those are two of the biggest, you know, intelligence, stimulation, all of those different aspects of our life we need. So that's some very insightful stuff. I love it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So now that there's more pressure on you from sponsors, from, you know, an increased audience, probably more self-pressure as you kind of talked mm-hmm. about just now with your increased success, what changes have you noticed in yourself?
It's actually kind of funny. The changes that I've noticed in myself is that I am almost retracting more from that. So I'm still very active on social media, don't get me wrong, but that was, you know, I built those platforms up, and that's ultimately how I grew obviously it's how I grew the audience that I have. It's how I attracted the sponsors that I have. But, you know, with that comes a lot more with it. And don't get me wrong, I get much more positive feedback from people than negative, but there's always going to be harsh criticism no matter what you do, if you have a large audience watching you. And what that's made me do is, honestly, it's made me turn more towards the true, you know, pillars of my life, the true things that are holding me up, you know, my family, my friends. I've really dove into relationships more. And because I do have the tendency, and it's, I don't want to say it's from a selfish place, but I know it's something that I need that I will not give myself if I don't force myself. Mm-hmm. I need people to support me. Because, like, I mean, we all need people to support us. We're creatures of interaction. But, you know, I've tried to be the one-woman show. I've tried to be an island, you know, for 22 years. Sometimes it's worked and sometimes it's dug me into a real deep hole. But I just know and value so much more close. And especially with social media, things feel a lot less intimate with social media because it's, you know, it's all out there, whatever. But I've put so much more value in close, intimate relationships and that quality time with the people that are in my immediate three-dimensional circle. And, you know, not talking about things like bodybuilding, not focusing on the sport side of things, but just genuinely coming back to that core of who you are. It's also forced me to get into more mental care practices like meditation, mindfulness, going to a therapist, all that stuff, because I'm really interested to see where psychology research goes in regards to the impact of things like social media on human psychology, because I've definitely felt its impact on me. And I actually read a really amazing book called American Girls this past year about the impact of social media on young women and how they grow up. But I'm just curious to see how, you know, that pans out over the next couple of years. But I know that it's definitely, from the social media side of things, it's a burden mentally. And so just learning to truly let that out instead of keeping it inside, I think that's been a big transformation as well.
That's huge. I can definitely attest to that myself. And for me, it's not, it has nothing to do with body image, but social media, I fall into the trap of comparing myself to others in business, right? I see someone out there doing something amazing, and it triggers this kind of like envy in me, right? And this like, I'm not good enough, or I can't do that kind of mentality. So a couple things. One, that gives me an opportunity to really work on noticing that feeling of envy and honoring it, and just like working through it and not calling that like reality. But then also, I have the opportunity to not look at social media so often. So I have this app called Freedom, and it blocks my social media apps when I want. They're on like a recurring cycle. So I can't access social media very often throughout the day, which is amazing. But yeah, that definitely resonates with me.
That's awesome. And you know what, you brought up a really interesting point about truly feeling what it feels like to have that negative feeling towards someone, like envy. You said the example of envy. I think we're in the midst of like a cultural norm where it's like the positivity movement. Like I love that we're all focused on being more positive. I think that's exactly what our culture needs. But in along the same vein, what I notice people doing now is they completely cast out any negative emotion and they just pretend it doesn't exist. It's, oh, things are not great, but I'm just going to forget they're not great and only focus on the good. And while I think there's absolutely a tremendous amount of value in exercising gratitude in adverse situations, we also have to know how to process negative emotions. And what that requires is truly sitting with and being present in that feeling. You can't get over a feeling if you've never felt it and you've never allowed it to infiltrate your body. Like there's something to be said, you know, when you feel really happy, when something really good happens, you know, that like warm feeling that washes over you, that's how you know what happiness feels like. And that's how you work with it. With negative emotions, with negative things that happen to you, you don't know how to work with it if you've never had to sit down and have a conversation with it. So yes, the positivity movement is amazing. It's fabulous. It's wonderful. But also don't forget that we experience negative emotions too. There's duality in everything. We experience negative emotions too. And those still are valid. You know, emotions are neither wrong nor right. They just are. So they're still valid. And we still have to sit with those and feel those and decide what to do with them instead of just kind of throwing them in the closet and closing the door or brushing them under the rug.
I really like the saying, something to the effect that any feeling felt fully doesn't last longer than 5 to 7 minutes. So in anything felt, you know, if you're get present with the physical sensation, no matter how bad it is, if you really just get into that feeling and not in the story in your head and continue to fuel it, then it's just gone like a storm, right? Everything just passes over us.
No, I love that. And I think that's 100% true. Yeah, I love it.
Who is someone that you look up to either in the sport or someone in general that you just really look up to that embodies some of these characteristics that you've been working on so hard?
This is going to sound so corny, and I really hope she's listening to this because I know she listens to your podcast, and I'm going to get emotional because like when you have a best friend like this, like it's an emotional experience. But my best friend, Chanel Collette, we actually, it's crazy. We both moved to Louisville literally at the exact same time. She also competes in bikini. She's a truly, truly amazing individual. And she has been probably the single most, in the past year, year and a half, I'd say she's the single most pivotal person in my personal growth. She's taught me so many lessons, and just she truly embodies what it means to love something for the love of it and not for the fact that you're being celebrated for doing it. You know, mm-hmm. she does this because she loves it. She attacks her training because she truly loves it. She competes because she truly loves it, but she also doesn't hold her facility. And what I mean like by facility is like her physical appearance, her physical body. She doesn't hold that to such an esteem that it distracts her from living her best life and from being a fierce competitor. Cause you know, if you get too attached to your body image as a competitor, you will never improve, because there comes a time when the lines and the striations have to fade in order to improve upon that's already there. Mm-hmm. So just from who she is as an athlete perspective and just to who she is as a person perspective, she is truly somebody that I look up to. And you know, she's about 10 years older than me, so I hope to God when I'm 32 that I'm as strong of a role model as she is for other people. And she's just been, if there's anybody that I ever need advice on with anything, it's her that I go to no matter what it is, because I trust her opinion and I trust her objectivity. And it's incredibly peaceful to have a friend like that that you can trust but also look up to at the same time.
Wow, what a badass. What has she taught you about being a good friend? What have you, or just what have you learned through your experience?
One of my favorite things about Chanel, and this is coming from an introvert, and she's an introvert as well, but this is something that, like, especially as an introvert, I am very not apt to do. She is always trying to bring people together. She is always, you know, bringing our friend group together. You know, whenever we all hang out, we're going to Chanel's house, we're gonna, you know, smoke some meat in their smoker, we're gonna play games, we're gonna have a good time, we're gonna spend time with each other. And so she is just so amazing about bringing our friend group together. Like, I wouldn't have over half of the rest of the friends that I have here in Louisville now if it wasn't for her, because she's always bringing people together. And another thing, so there's that, but she's also just, no matter what it is, she is always willing to be there. She's willing to, I'm going to get emotional. She's willing to be in the trenches with you, no matter what those trenches look like. Mm-hmm. And she's able to help you out of them just simply by being there. There's like this quote that talks about how like the best thing you can do for another person is just to be with them in the middle of the storm. And that's what she is. And she's amazing.
Right. To really meet them, like true empathy means meeting them where they're at emotionally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And she pushes me, you know, I think that's another marker of a good friend, is they always kind of like how we were talking about with training and stuff, pushing yourself at the edge of your abilities. She does that for me too. So we're training partners, when our schedules allow, and she always pushes me to be better and to do better both in training and in life, and to just really stick to my mission, both in training and, you know, especially with social media, really sticking true to my messages and all that. So yeah, she's just all around great person.
Right on. So cool. Okay. Moving on. So I want to talk about mindset a little bit. And we've been talking a lot about that, but kind of performance mindset. What part of your mental performance do you value the most? Like, what belief or mental state do you think most contributes to your success in your sport or just life in general?
I would say, especially in the context of athletics, but it's also trickled over into like academia and work and stuff like that, but it's my discipline. So I, like I mentioned, I grew up in classical ballet, and for people that aren't familiar with classical ballet, it's like the epitome of extreme discipline and regimentation. Like, if your foot's not precisely correct in your passe, or your turnout needs work, or your jumping footwork is sloppy, you're going to do it again and again and again and again and again, and then like 10 more times until it's right. And then once it's right, you're probably going to do it like another 30. And, you know, there's always that dance teacher that throws in an extra 4 8 counts after they said this is your last 8 count. Mm-hmm. No, it's never done. You're never done. But yeah, ballet, it really taught me that excellence is achieved through discipline and practice. And like I said, I started dancing when I was 1 and a half, danced till I was 17. That's a long time to learn practice and intense discipline. So in the context of, you know, especially something like a contest prep, or even, you know, strength athletes carry this in the context of a meet prep, or if you're prepping for the games or something like that, you are only in control of your variables. So you're only in control of obviously the things that you can control, whether or not you're hitting your nutrition, whether or not you're doing the training sessions that you should be doing, whether or not your sleep is on point, kind of like we talked about earlier, all of those other things matter. And those are all things that require self-control and discipline. And honestly, it trickles over into everyday life too, because the only things that we're able to control are our actions and our reactions. You know, we can't control what happens to us. We control how we react to it. We can't control who shows up on competition or game day. We can only do our best and have confidence in the peace in that we've done what we needed to do in order to be what we set out to be. And that has to be enough. But that, for me, comes from discipline, and just kind of like going down the rabbit hole of that. Discipline for me, it's become kind of, in a way, it's like a comfort thing. You know, when I was in first grade, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer, and thankfully she's still with us. But like, I remember finding a letter that she wrote to my sister and I in case she didn't make it. And like, seeing that when you're in first grade, like, that's nuts. And I grew up super close to my grandparents on both sides. They were basically like my sister and his babysitters. And my grandpa Berman, he was this amazing businessman, but he was diagnosed with lung cancer and he passed away when I was in fifth grade. My grandma Carolyn, his wife, passed away a few years later. Then a few years ago when I was 18, my papa Jack passed away from Parkinson's. So like, growing up, yeah, I lived a comfortable middle class life, but I've also been regularly reminded that there is so much painful stuff that happens outside of my control. What I did and do have the power to control are my actions and reactions. And especially I've grown up in, you know, dance and now bodybuilding. Those things require action and reaction by way of discipline. And so, and you know, I think that, yeah, it carries over into every aspect of athletics. And I think that's why, part of why so many people gravitate towards athletics is that it's what you do is within your control. And that's like kind of going down the rabbit. We mentioned Holiday when we were talking at the beginning before we started recording, but like, I think that's part of why I like Stoic philosophy so much, is that's one of its main agendas, or like one of the main things, at least I take away from it, is it's not that we get to control what happens to us. It's that we get to control how we react to those happenings. And so I don't think you'll ever find an elite athlete or an elite business person or an elite anyone, world-class anyone, that just kind of lucked into whatever they're world-class at. That's happened through discipline and commitment and time. So yeah, I'd say, long story, I talk so much, I'm so sorry.
No, but that's perfect.
The key benchmark in my success has been my discipline and my diligence, because I truly, when my mind is set on something, going back to being bullheaded, when my mind is set on something, I do that thing and I go for that thing, and I don't want to disrespect my goals by not serving them absolutely how they need to be served.
Love it. So you had this experience of being in a sport at a very young age that helped you build this skill of discipline. For someone that's already in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, they're already an adult and they don't have that opportunity. How would you recommend they build discipline in their life?
You know, I'd
or
say
become this, disciplined.
Yeah. This is something that I continually try and work on with my clients. I work mostly with Gen Pop clients, and that's like a big struggle for most people, especially with something like diet and training, is developing that consistency. So if we're going to get real specific with something like diet, you know, building, and this could go over into any area of your life that you're trying to improve, but create kind of like a tier system. So at the top of the tiers, you have the utmost level of discipline that you really want to achieve. But this level, it also has to, you know, obviously directly benefit whatever you're trying to achieve. At the bottom level, that's one step that you can take every single day to getting to that top tier. So with something like nutrition, you know, just starting by keeping a food journal of what you're eating. So then you at least have some awareness of what you're eating. And then maybe from there, moving up to tracking your daily calories, you know, starting at a slightly higher level of food journaling in that way. So keeping track of your calories, then from there, trying to move up to, you know, okay, maybe now we start tracking calories, protein, and fiber. And that's another tier. And it's a little bit more specific. And then you move up from there to overall calories, and then 3 macronutrients in your fiber, and just working your way up this tier system to specificity, that specificity that like helps you get to whatever goal you're trying to achieve. But at the most important thing is at that baseline level, it has to be something that's achievable, achievable for you? You know, in, I think it was my sports psychology class, my junior year, we were talking about, self-efficacy, and self-efficacy, part of how that is bred is by doing things that, and achieving things and like accomplishing something, because then that gives you the self-efficacy and the self-confidence to say, oh, I did something that I set out to do. I can do that again because I've already done it. So setting up a system for yourself where you're like, okay, this is one habit or one thing that I'm going to do every single day. And like, you can check off, and it has to be measurable, you know, something that you can check off every single day. Like, I got 8 hours of sleep last night, or I was in bed by 10:30, or whatever it is. And it's something that you can measure every single day. And then you can build on that. You know, once you've got the confidence of say, hey, I've been doing this consistently for, you know, a few weeks, a few months, like let's add another thing onto it. And before you know it, you're like this super efficiently running machine. And so, yeah, I think just everyday person, find simple things that you can improve upon. One really, really easy thing is something like getting to bed on time. We have the tendency to sit and scroll on our phone, sit and scroll through social media, whatever it is. And we end up going to bed, you know, 2-3 hours later than we intended on. That's one really easy way you can start. Or simply something even more basic than that, waking up and drinking a glass of water as soon as you wake up. That's super important. We all need water. Like, that's kind of a non-negotiable. But starting out with these little things that that are something that you're not already doing, that require a little bit of extra effort than what you already have in practice, and then just building upon that gradually and being, you know, sticking with that. You know, if you don't have a coach screaming in your ear, it's a lot more difficult. So whatever your bigger goal is that all of these smaller daily disciplines feed into, there has to be a strong, strong why behind all of that. So it can't just be, I want to lose 5 pounds. There has to be like a deeper reason behind whatever you're doing.
I absolutely love that. I was just talking to a friend, Justin Sua, who we were talking about just this, and he mentioned the concept of a lead domino. So when you're choosing that first like benchmark habit, or that first thing to start to build that self-efficacy, that integrity with yourself, try to pick something that, if done successfully, will make everything else either unnecessary or easier to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, I love what you said by going to bed at the right time. So most people will focus on just waking up at a certain time, and that's when they're gonna, you know, have their morning routine and prepare their food for the day or whatever it is they want to do. And then, but they don't realize they're not going to sleep on time, and that's why they can't consistently wake up. So going to sleep at, you know, say 9 or 10 every night can be a really great way to set yourself up to wake up the next day, to prepare, and et cetera, et cetera. But by focusing on that one thing of going to sleep on time, it makes everything else just that much easier to accomplish.
Absolutely. It's like you reverse engineer whatever your big goal is, and you figure out, like you said, whatever that first domino is.
Yep.
100%. And I don't know if this is just a me thing, but especially with sleep, it doesn't matter if I get the exact same amount of hours of sleep. If I'm asleep, or at least in my sleep starting process, like my lights are off, my phone is off, my eyes are closed, all that, by 10 o'clock, I have a much better and more restful sleep than if I get the exact same amount of sleep if I go to bed at 11. It's a weird personal thing. I don't know if that happens to anybody else, but yeah, we all have our own personal rhythm. So that's just like a random thing.
Yeah, I think there's some science behind that that I won't even attempt to unpack, as you call it. All right, I want to finish out with this. So there are so many people out there, so many ladies especially, that are trying to do what you've done successfully. They're trying to build a personal brand around fitness. What do you think it is about you and your approach on social media and in person and in life in general that's made you stand out and has led to your success?
I think it's being organic with yourself. You know, I have my little Wonder Woman mentality phrase, which like I've talked about this a million times, but in case anybody listening to Brute Strength hasn't heard, it was 2014, it was the summer of 2014. I was on a radio interview, and I was asked if I could give young women one piece of advice, what would it be? And I said, become your own Wonder Woman. Don't let the energy of the outside world fuel you. Find out what makes you strong and what makes you awesome and run with it. And the reason why that is so important to me is because I spent so much time growing up you know, whether it was trying to deny the natural body that I was born with because I felt shame for it, that also infiltrated it into me trying to fit in with different groups of people that I didn't fit in with, and essentially disowning myself at my core in order to fit in with somebody else or some other group or to please some ballet teacher from when I was 8 years old. And lack of authenticity is the biggest disservice you can do to yourself. And I think that's really played out for me on social media. You know, I got into social media just because, you know, when I was in high school, that's when Instagram kind of started to be a thing. And you would just post about what you were doing with your life. And so when I started to get into training and going to the gym and nutrition and all of that, that's just what I posted about because that's naturally what I was doing. It's not something that felt like I had to put a ton of effort into it. It came naturally. So whatever it is that you're doing and whatever your brand is that you're trying to grow or business that you're trying to grow, it's going to be a lot easier to grow if it's coming from an organic and sincere place in your heart. And I think that people now, especially, they're getting a lot better at picking up on lack of authenticity, and people don't want that. You know, especially with social media, people want real, people want genuine. People don't want to see this veil up between you and the audience. They want to see who you are and they want to see what you stand for. So in your, whether it's as an athlete, whether it's your business, find out who you are. You know, that's the first part. You can't stick to who you are if you don't know who that is. Figure out what your core values are and stick to those and just kind of let the rest flow naturally.
Couldn't say it better myself. I love that. I'm reading Brené Brown's new book, and she talks about, and it's all on belonging. And mm-hmm. she says to belong to others, we first have to belong to ourselves. And the only way to do that is by being ourselves, by being authentic. Mm-hmm. So that's such a great place to cut this one off. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much. Where can people find out more about you, stalk you on social media, all of that stuff?
Well, social media would definitely be the best place. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter. They're the same handle. I try to keep it easy for everyone, but it's at @MEM_DUNC. So @M_dunk. You can also find me on YouTube at youtube.com/MDunk. And then also I do have my personal website where I have my blog, where I have all my programs, all that stuff, you know, more in-depth bio in case I haven't, you know, word vomited on you enough. And that is www.emilyduncanfitness.com. And then the last one, I think, is I do have my own podcast that I started this past May, I believe, and that is Embody Radio. So you can just search Embody Radio on iTunes and SoundCloud, and you can join me in all those different parties.
Boom. And guys, if you have not subscribed to this podcast yet, what are you doing?
I know. Get out there and subscribe. That was critical mistake number one.
Thank you so much, Emily. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me, Mike.